Hello. On this week's program, we listen back to an interview with the pianist and broadcaster Christopher O'Reilly. Jason Pfeiffer explores how the skills and traditions of folk art are being passed on through apprenticeships, and Susan Lewis considers the Philadelphia Zoo the nation's oldest zoological gardens. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Christopher O'Reilly is probably best known as the host of the nationally syndicated radio program From the Top. The show that features the cream of young classical musicians can be heard each Saturday afternoon on WRTI. In addition to his duties as a radio host, O'Reilly is a classically trained pianist who continues to tour and perform regularly. But he isn't just playing Mozart, Debussy or Shostakovich. In recent years, O'Reilly has been applying his classical know-how to some unexpected repertoire. Originally used as a fill between segments on From the Top, and spurred by his fascination with the rock band Radiohead, O'Reilly's classical interpretations of that band's music, as well as songs by the recently deceased folk rocker Elliott Smith and the 1970s British singer-songwriter Nick Drake, have been met with both critical and commercial success. In these recordings and in companion recitals, O'Reilly bridges two very different audiences. So when we met, I first asked Christopher O'Reilly why a classical musician would want to interpret rock and pop music.
I don't really approach the arrangements that I do by virtue of any sort of overarching concept. The fact that I ended up doing not one but two Radiohead records of piano arrangements had more to do with the fact that that was just the music in my head, and I was listening to just about, you know, nothing but Radiohead. But at the same time, there were other songs that were really catching my imagination, and I was actually doing other arrangements around the same time as I was doing Radiohead, including Elliott Smith and including, right at the very beginning of the whole process, Nick Drake. It's just a matter of what song I'm listening to hundreds of times and can't get away from. So it's never really a matter of a project. It's really a matter of just sort of a connection. With me, it's the same connection as it is for any of the classical repertoire that I play. I'm really quite compelled and drawn to particular sort of sensuous harmonic language that I feel is shared by people like Elliott Smith and Dmitri Shostakovich and Claude Debussy and Radiohead and Messiaen and various other people. That and also a sense of textural ingenuity. I've always been drawn to the music of Robert Schumann for the fact that, you know, even if he has hundreds of songs, each song has an accompaniment figure in the piano that is completely indelibly unique to that particular song. Likewise, with Radiohead, for instance, you don't have this sort of wall of sound kind of organization of musical structure. You have five members of the band, each of whom are contributing a particular thread to the overall texture, and that by itself suggests, you know, how one might go about devising a piano version of something like that. And it also gets me out of let's say, like a jazz musician would have certain physical habits at the piano. It draws me out of myself. You know, getting into, for instance, Nick Drake's guitar playing, there are certain patterns that he uses that if I'm trying to be true to them, makes my job easier in terms of I don't know, making it, you know, unique to Nick Drake and not just a matter of me sort of jangling around it with the patterns of my own hands. Similarly, with Elliott Smith's music, you have a widely diverse body of work between the studio versions of a song and, let's say, the 100 or so live versions of each song that Elliott wrote, and how he made choices, you know, from the studio version, which was largely self-produced with his material, to the solo live performances, in which case, well, you know, he's making choices. You know, what are the elements that are absolutely essential to the song, and so what choices has he made in that circumstance, and how should that affect the way I play it on the piano? Kinds of interesting sort of threads that sort of catch my ear and lead me into the song, and then the way through it is always a matter of editing and revision, and of course, you know, because it's not my material, it's my doing the best I can to make the other material come alive.
And is it the case that it's Chris O'Reilly using his language to express Nick Drake, or is Nick Drake teaching you a separate vernacular that in turn feeds into the other music that you play?
Well, I like to think that I'm trying, in the same way that I'm, you know, trying to approach a Beethoven concerto, trying to get inside what, you know, what was in Beethoven's mind, how he eventually, you know, wrote it down, makes a very large difference to me insofar as how far away I ever want to get from that kind of, you know, the law of the line, the law of the, you know, what's on the page. I'm you know, with Nick, I'm trying to understand what he was trying to do and get away from some of the extraneous things, you know, other playing styles that contributed to the album that may not really have been what he had in mind. And there are some pretty, you know, interesting examples of those kinds of disparities that make it really quite inspiring. So yeah, I don't really think of it in terms of doing it my way. It's just, you know, I guess the way that I hear things, the way that I try and emulate certain things that are unavailable to the piano, the way, for instance, you try and approximate the sound of the human voice. I give a large nod to Thelonious Monk in that regard, because a lot of what people refer to as wrong note playing, I try and imagine he was trying to emulate the voice. He was trying to emulate the plaintency of the saxophone, etc. With Nick Drake, for instance, you know, one of the modes of authenticity that I'm most strict about is the way that he phrased. I mean, he was a remarkable musician in that he sort of was pigeonholed within the folk world. But at the same time, when you actually listen to his vocal phrasing, it's really straight out of the jazz tradition. And so that's an interesting juxtaposition within the style, this man almost singing to himself, but with an exuberance to the harmony and an exuberance to the rhythmic placement and the phrasing within the song that makes it, you know, unique, makes it Nick Drake.
Better set you pray today for the sky to blow away, or maybe stay.
But yeah, Riverman particularly, you know, speaks to the jazz sensibility, I think.
Gonna see the Riverman, gonna tell him all I can about the band. On feeling free. Thank you.
with this wide expanse of interest and of knowledge in all types of musical forms that you have, is there ever a point when the piano becomes restricting? Have you ever thought about perhaps having a larger ensemble? Maybe even think about conducting symphony orchestras, well, for instance.
Well, I think the piano, you know, part of what I'm doing is sort of showing off the instrument, you know, because I think it is capable of just about anything. I tend to think that what I'm doing is as little a reduction as possible. I'm trying to approximate the same kind of energy and the same kind of excitement that a full band version of any of the songs that I like maintain. But I haven't really felt compelled to make versions for, let's say, piano and orchestra, for instance, because I think historically, inherently, there's a sense of protagonist, antagonist, or protagonist and the Greek chorus, etc., in the same way that you have a Beethoven concerto, that I feel wouldn't serve a Radiohead song terribly well. Even songs like How to Disappear Completely, which have their sort of quarter tone string haze about them, I suppose could work quite well for piano and orchestra, but there again, the piano, the orchestra would just be mere background, and I like musicians, and I like them to feel engaged and like they're doing something important.
It's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Great pleasure. Thanks, Jeff.
Christopher O'Reilly. His latest CD, Second Grace, the music of Nick Drake, is available now on World Village Records.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
With the rapid pace of 21st century life, aspects of traditional arts and crafts run the risk of being lost. The nuances and distinct styles of folk art, arts and crafts that are an outgrowth of everyday life, aren't taught in art schools and conservatories. As older ways of life fade away, so too do hands-on skills and customs. But one way these traditions are passed on is through apprenticeships. And as WRTI's Jason Pipe reports, the teaching and learning is happening throughout the country, both formally and informally.
The idea of an apprenticeship may bring to mind Donald Trump's television show, The Apprentice, but this method of passing on techniques and knowledge was around well before television of any kind. Apprenticeship systems date back centuries. For many years, it was the principal means by which people learned trades, tailors, shoemakers, butchers, and painters. Entering into an agreement with a master, young apprentices would gain vocational skills in exchange for labor, sometimes committing to work for little or no pay until the age of 21. With the proliferation of schools, technology, and labor laws, apprenticeships are less common today, though not unheard of. Many electricians and sheet metal workers, for example, go through a formal apprenticeship process. And the intensive learning and teaching model has a special role in the world of folk art. Barry Berge is the director of folk and traditional arts at the National Endowment for the Arts, the NEA.
It's an age-old process, really, of one-on-one teaching and mentoring, usually through oral tradition and demonstration. It certainly isn't unique to folk arts, but it's very appropriate to folk and traditional arts.
Appropriate, because the techniques and skills involved with many folk and traditional arts are very hands-on and detail-oriented. Teaching and learning traditions like glass blowing, banjo making, cultural dances, quilting, basket weaving, and pottery require a great deal of individual attention. Though apprenticeships have been taking place informally for a long time, the NEA has used the apprenticeship model, bringing together a master artist and an apprentice in a formal way since 1983. Barry Berge explains the NEA does this by administering grants through state programs to master artists.
The problem for many traditional artists, at least, is that they may have to earn their living through another career. So the apprenticeship allows them the time and supports their time, I would say not as generously sometimes as we would like, to do that teaching. So we're in effect making it worth their while to teach.
And more often than not, experienced and accomplished folk artists are eager to teach and pass on what they know. Deborah Kodish, director and founder of the Philadelphia Folklore Project, which often helps masters and apprentices apply for government support, says this exchange is taken very seriously.
Someone who has spent their life feeling like they're a custodian of a tradition and they feel responsible to a community for keeping this legacy available, they're looking for somebody who's going to take that on after them. So this has been important because that's not a government program, that's a government program, recognizing that this is a way that these forms have really been kept going.
In many cases, artistic traditions have been passed along through one-on-one relationships without giving a thought to whether or not it was technically an apprenticeship. Philadelphia Folklore Project Associate Director Jermaine Ingram studied and performed for nearly 20 years with the late LaVon Robinson, an internationally acclaimed tap dance artist and teacher. Ingram says during that time, they never called their relationship an apprenticeship.
He was my friend, he was my teacher, he was my mentor.
But Ingram recognizes that what they had was essentially an apprenticeship. She would meet with Robinson every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. to learn his Philly style of tap dance. Ingram says her strong commitment to the art form resulted.
These mentoring apprenticeship relationships, I mean, if they are truly that, I mean, I think we've sort of watered down words so much that, you know, what people call mentoring these days is hard for me to recognize as such. But when you have deep, intense, long-term relationships, you can develop a depth of understanding, a depth of appreciation, and really learn to respect the tradition.
Terrence Cameron, who lives in West Philadelphia, is a master in the art of steel drum making. For decades, he worked from the basement of his home, making and repairing the Caribbean-style musical instrument, traditionally created from 55-gallon steel oil drums.
And each one is a different note. We have like octaves.
Raised in Trinidad, Cameron says he was first exposed to the sound of the steel drum as a young boy, music that immediately captivated him, though he initially had to hide his love of steel drums from his parents.
It had a bad stigma to it. I think the people, the street gangs, they created the steel drum. You know, your parents didn't want you to be associated with a steel drum.
As a teenager, Terrence Cameron began an informal apprenticeship with Stanley Warner, one of the first great masters of steel drum making, traveling with Warner around Trinidad to make and play drums. For nearly 50 years, Cameron continued crafting and repairing drums up until a few years ago when arthritis set in. Along the way, Cameron did what many former apprentices do. He took on apprentices of his own. With perspective from both sides of apprenticeship, Cameron notes there's a key component, time.
I mean, you can't learn to make a steel drum in a week or two or a month. It takes years and years and years of, you know, trial and error.
Every apprenticeship looks different. Some pairs might meet once a week, others every few days, and for someone like Vera Nakonechny, maybe every day. Nakonechny, who emigrated to the U.S. when she was a teenager, specializes in Ukrainian embroidery. On two occasions, she brought over an expert on the traditional art form from Ukraine to live with her and her family in Philadelphia for months at a time. Nakonechny says there are about 200 different stitches and more than 20 different techniques associated with traditional Ukrainian embroidery.
I think I master about 12 to 15. There's a lot more to learn.
Nakonechny is passionate about learning and teaching these different embroidery techniques of her culture because while Ukraine was under the Soviet regime, these traditions were nearly lost. The communist government discouraged many folk art practices. When Ukraine opened up again in the early 90s, Nakonechny began traveling to her homeland on a yearly basis to conduct archival research about Ukrainian folk art traditions and help keep them alive. Nakonechny says her main goal is to not only learn for herself, but also pass that knowledge on to newer generations, and one-on-one apprenticeships help to do that well. But she says in contrast to the casual learning that might happen in a classroom or workshop setting, it's crucial that apprentices also have deep passion for the art form.
An apprenticeship is that person really wants to learn and really wants to expand the knowledge. There is a hunger of doing it and knowing and refining techniques.
In an age with so much transience and technology offering endless entertainment options, it's arguably more difficult in the 21st century to structure lives into intimate, time-intensive apprenticeships. Then again, mobility and technology might be the very things that help sustain folkways, exposing the traditions to a wider audience. Just as there are those who are eager to share their knowledge of arts and crafts, it's clear there are many around who are hungry to learn and carry on these same traditions.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. In an age of technologically driven entertainment options, from big screen TVs to video arcades to the latest in digital sound and light shows, one of the most visited family attractions in the Philadelphia area still relies on the natural world for its appeal. But the Philadelphia Zoo's mission is not simply entertainment. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at how the zoo has changed with the times in its approach to its animals, its visitors, and the vanishing wild.
In 1859, the charter of the Zoological Society of Philadelphia was signed, the first of its kind in the nation. Despite its early start, the Civil War intervened, and the zoo gates didn't open to the public until July 1, 1874, when the city was getting ready for the country's centennial celebration. Rachel DeCaro, who manages the zoo's archives, says the people behind the zoo were thinking in international and scientific terms.
This society wanted to do more of what they had in Europe, a zoo with more of a purpose than just caging animals and looking at them. The nutrition program at the zoo was the first of its type. The pathology program was the first of its type in the entire world.
The zoo was located on the outskirts of the city, in what must have seemed an ideal garden setting. Already on the property was Solitude, the neoclassical home of William Penn's grandson, John Penn. Frank Furness designed the Victorian gates and gatehouses. The trip from the city was made by streetcars, horse and carriage, or steamboat down the Schuylkill River.
At that time, it was really to be a refuge away from the city, sort of an oasis.
Vikram Dewan is the president of the Philadelphia Zoo.
Today, the city is all around us. We are as much a part of the city and integrated into the fabric of the city as almost anything else.
It still has a garden feel, but that of a city garden, where the buzzing of airplanes overhead, the roar of leaf blowers on the ground, and the hum of city traffic on the nearby expressway mingle with the vocalizing of lions, monkeys, and exotic parrots, not to mention all the young humans.
The birdhouse or the giraffes and the monkeys, those are my three favorites.
Big Cat Falls, Bear Country, and the reptiles.
Providing a look at animals from around the world is still the zoo's biggest draw. Public education about those animals is a second goal, one that former director of education, Kathy Wagner, says has been around since the beginning.
The Philadelphia Zoo's charter back in 1859 actually talks about the Philadelphia Zoo as being a place for public education and recreation. I think it really hasn't been until the last 20 or 30 years that we've really come to actualize that education mission and make it real in terms of multiple school programs, members programs, opportunities for families to become engaged.
Also in the last 30 years, a third purpose, conservation, became a driving force in the mission of zoos. People working with animals in zoos and the wild realized that human intervention was causing species to become extinct. And human intervention could, in some cases, save them. Andrew Baker, former vice president of animal programs, now chief operating officer, says the Philadelphia Zoo was involved in a 1980s rescue after a snake from one Pacific island stowed away on a ship and came onto land at Guam.
And basically the snake consumed all the land-based birds on Guam. And there was sort of a last-ditch rescue effort, and two species were successfully brought off the island, the Guam rail and the Guam Micronesian kingfisher. And they're alive only because we rescued the last few and started captive breeding programs. And the Philadelphia Zoo has been leading the kingfisher captive breeding program for a number of years. We started out with only 20. We're now up over 100.
After rescue, the species is reintroduced to its native environment. But saving a species through captive breeding, or in zoo lingo, operating as an ark, is a last resort, says Baker. The zoo is one of 214 accredited by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums.
So we're not looking at necessarily what's best for our zoo or what's best for the Omaha Zoo or what's best for the Bronx Zoo. It's really what's best for the entire population.
As an example, the zoo's care of the Amur tiger and her cubs in the exhibit Big Cat Falls is part of a national program. President Vikram Dewan says the tigers create awareness about programs in the wild.
What we hope people are leaving with is an understanding that there are only 400 Amur tigers left in the world, and that they, through irresponsible practices that we human beings have had around poaching, illegal hunting, encroaching on habitat and the like, what we have done in turn is really taken a magnificent species and decimated it. And so what we're hoping that people learn is that there is a stewardship responsibility that comes from that.
Duan says the zoo partners with others in international conservation efforts, providing both financial and people resources. People like Andrew Baker, who earned his PhD in animal behavior studying the golden lion tamarins.
And I've continued to study them in the wild and work on a conservation project. Multiple staff have gone down with me to help study them, track their demography, understand the threats to them in the wild.
The zoo's approach to animals in captivity is to put them in environments where they'll thrive. As examples, shifting tunnels in the back of Big Cat Falls enable lions and tigers to take turns roaming in each other's spaces. In the primate reserve, the perching, or tree-like climbing structures, are movable and changed to provide variety. Two primates that would never meet in the wild, an orangutan and a white-handed gibbon, are housed together because they seem to enjoy each other's company. And on the day we visit, a purple plastic ride-on toy, probably not common in the jungle, sits in the exhibit of the Duke Langer, a monkey native to Vietnam. Erin McCool is the public programs coordinator.
The goal of all of our enrichment programs here at the zoo is to enable the animals to act sort of as they would in the wild. You notice they probably don't see a big, huge purple toy in the wild, but if it encourages them to do the things that they would in the wild, to manipulate items, to forage for their food, that means that we're doing the right thing.
Outdoors, near a visitor path, golden lion tamarins, small monkeys with golden fur and manes around their faces, play in the trees outside a large cage in the middle of a wooded patch of land, under the watchful eyes of several zoo employees. Native to Brazil, during the day the animals free range, meaning go wherever they want. Mostly golden lion tamarins are family-oriented and tend to be home buddies, with one exception.
As the babies grow up to be adolescents, they tend to venture a little bit further from the group. Mom tamarin will call, and you know the other tamarins will call to them, so you'll hear lots of noise, and they're incredibly loud. They almost sound like birds.
One destination of adolescent tamarins is a nearby statue of a gorilla who once lived at the zoo. The zoo has over 40 sculptures accenting its gardens. The dying lioness, created for the Centennial Exhibition, has sat outside the main gates since 1876. It is said to symbolize the need for animal preservation. While the zoo has over 1,300 animals from all over the world, it does not have, or not for long, elephants. Andrew Baker says losing the elephants is a consequence of concern about what animals need, as well as the ever-present challenge of funding.
As our understanding of animals and our own internal expectations change, we've been changing the environments for almost every animal here at the zoo. We had on the books a plan for a brand new elephant facility at the south end of the zoo, multi-acre, much more flexible, larger and more creative environment for the elephants. Unfortunately, we have not been successful at the fundraising piece for that.
Also, confinement to 42 acres necessarily limits the kind of open-air space the zoo can devote to animal habitats.
No, we're never going to have a huge collection of large hoofstock. Antelope, deer, wild goats. But I think what we offer is an intimate experience where people can really make connections with animals and with each other.
So if you come in with your family or friends on a Sunday afternoon, you might be greeted at the entrance with someone with maybe one of our Madagascar hissing cockroaches. So that's an educational experience that you might not expect.
We use the fact that people are able to get whisker close to animals, that moves them to being able to want to learn more about the planet that for which we have responsibility.
And this interaction between people and animals is perhaps the most effective way of accomplishing three key goals of the Philadelphia Zoo: public education, recreation, and conservation of animals and the world around us.
WRTI, Susan Lewis. The zoo's last two elephants are leaving in mid-September for the International Conservation Center in Fairhope, Somerset County, Pennsylvania. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of previous shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.